You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Financial crises are nothing new. In fact, they've been with us probably since the invention of money. But each time a boon takes off, many find solace in the idea that the old rules and precedents are somehow obsolete. And when the bus comes, well, that's somehow different too. Harvard economist Kenneth Rogoff has examined the hard data from nearly a millennia of financial catastrophe and cataloged it in his book, This Time is Different, 8 Centuries of Financial Folly. It's co-authored with Carmen Reinhart and published by Princeton University Press, and I'm pleased to welcome Professor Rogoff to the Leonard Lopate Show today. Hi, Ken.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeff, for having me.
It's great. It's great to have you. Okay, before we get into the sort of economic prescriptions, I'm curious about what it means to research a book about 800 years of financial history. How do you find out what the economy of anywhere was like in the 1300s, in the 1400s?
Well, obviously, it gets a lot thinner as you go back in time. But we rely, you know, basically on the work of many other scholars around the world. We cover 66 countries in 8 centuries. We couldn't possibly travel the whole world looking, in basements of churches to find records. You couldn't have done what we did before the internet. It's not that the data is on the internet. It's that you can contact people who might have written a thesis in 1960 on Venezuela and it's never been used, or perhaps get a rare book dealer in the Philippines and certainly contact a lot of other scholars. So we put together a lot of data that had never seen the light of day, really, even some from official sources that people just didn't realize existed.
Now, there are many charts in your book, although it is highly readable. There are a lot of economist charts. And there's one chart that I got a great kick out of because I understood it so little. It's a table, A14, the silver content of currencies. And you have Austria from 1371 to 1860, France from 1258 to 1789. Now, I understand you didn't do all the primary source research, but where does one even find out? Where does a scholar find out, you know, what the silver content of a currency was in the 14th century?
Well, actually, this is something where there's a lot written about it because it's a core monetary issue. We have the coins records and typically even the treasury would publish records of what the weight was. That was something that the king or whoever would establish. And so we rely on, for example, there was, Allen and Unger, Oxford University Press, had done a long study that covered a number of countries, but not all of the ones that we look at. This is actually an easy one, the silver content of currency.
Yeah.
It gets smaller and smaller and smaller, not surprisingly. That's what the chart showed. We call it the march towards fiat currency, meaning, you know, what they did in the old days, instead of just printing more money like they do now, is they kept diluting the currency. They would call it in, shave it, give you back half of what you gave them, and keep the other half and remint it. You can go to coins museums and see them getting smaller and smaller and smaller over time.
What the thesis of the book in many respects is this time is not different, that there are patterns that recur. Your title is ironic, I think it's safe to say. Is that right?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's ironic. Not everyone takes it that way, but it is ironic that that's what everyone says. We're really talking about the run-up to a crisis particularly. It's not going to happen. And frankly, the people who say this time is different are the few who even realize that there are lots of other crises and they happen. Those are the informed individuals, you know, who say we have financial globalization, better monetary policy. That was our story this time. But, you know, it could have been better management of the Latin American economies in the 1970s as the technocrats took over. After World War I, everybody said, well, all the countries that weren't involved in the war are probably fine and they're not going to have a problem. And, of course, we had the United States and on and on. And there's always a this time is different theme. It's something really remarkable that sort of inspired us as a unifying theme.
Yet you say that for all that this bad behavior recurs, the crises themselves are unpredictable. I think on the very first page you say unpredictable. How are those two sentiments consistent?
So you can't really predict the timing of a crisis until really it's right in your face, but you can predict the vulnerability. If you borrowed mountains of debt, if housing prices have doubled, those are examples of things that are very strong indicators that you're vulnerable. But it doesn't say it's going to happen next week. It's not doesn't say it's going to happen next year. I think people who say, I called the crisis, you know, you couldn't know for sure until really we were much closer to the event exactly when it was going to happen. It could have happened 2 years earlier, could have happened 2 years later. But, you know, look, if you didn't borrow anything, you're not going to have a debt crisis. And if you borrowed more than any reasonable assessment could think you're going to pay unless everything goes perfectly, you probably are. And you can look at those indicators. And I want to say once it happens, the aftermath is more predictable. And we find, you know, very strong regularities. What's happened in the United States is amazingly typical of a deep post-war financial crisis.
What's going on right now?
Yeah, how long unemployment lasts, how much it goes up, how much housing went down, how much the stock market went down and up. It is, we're right around the center, the mean of post-war experience.
You know, your book seems to have a kind of amused fatalism to it, that there is the idea that everybody thinks they can predict, everybody thinks they can cure, and in fact, it's all pretty hopeless. Is that an accurate assessment of your view, cheerful though it may be?
Well, certainly we find studying financial crises very exciting and interesting. Carmen and I have both worked on it our whole lives, and there are a lot of things that fascinate us. But I wouldn't quite go to say, well, let's not do anything, let's not bother. I mean, we're all going to die, but it's better to last 80 or 90 years than 20 years.
Yes.
You know, I mean, there are things you can do that affect your life expectancy, your general health. And the same thing's true for an economy. And so, but to think that it's never going to happen, we're just nowhere near that. And a point we'd made years ago in our research is, you know what? The rich countries have not outgrown banking crises. They have them just as much, and they're just as bad. And that was before this hit.
My guest is Kenneth Rogoff, professor at Harvard. We're discussing his latest book, This Time is Different, 8 Centuries of Financial Folly, published by Princeton University Press. So we are now in we hope, the aftermath of a great financial tumult, the Great Recession, as it's sometimes called. What caused it?
Well, I mean, the plain vanilla ingredients were that we had a huge credit bubble, lots and lots of borrowing, and we had a huge housing price boom, financial deregulation. These are very common elements. Certainly the fact that the U.S. was borrowing so much from abroad, two-thirds of world trade surpluses were absorbed by the United States. I mean, these are all strong leading indicators. And Carmen and I, in fact, had written a paper, you know, I would say within a year of the crisis saying, oh my gosh, look at all these indicators. They line up amazingly with countries that have had really deep financial crises. We wrote an academic paper, it's a scholarly paper, saying, well, we'd be pretty lucky to avoid the worst. We're not saying it's going to happen. But, you know, I think the people who attach it to one event, and I would particularly point at Lehman, people who say, you know what, if they had saved Lehman, it would just all have been a minor little recession and not the same thing.
And you don't buy that?
They're nuts.
Nuts is an economic term? Is that, yes.
In the technical definition of the term. I mean, you know, housing prices had gone up to a level where they had to come down significantly. I won't pick on any region, but, you know, there were some places where it was just ridiculous. And we were going to lose trillions of dollars out of the economy, and a lot of that was borrowed money. There's no pretty way to absorb that. There's no easy way. I think, obviously, if you had to play it again, you would try bailing out Lehman and see what happened and let it go bankrupt in a different way. But there were a lot of other banks knocking at the door, and frankly, they couldn't have bailed them all out politically. It was impossible.
This is perhaps a question that is more political than economic, but whose fault was it?
It was all of our faults. It really was. And I think one of the, you know, interesting things about this one is how hard it is for people to point fingers. I really find amusing seeing these congressional investigations where they drag in Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner and Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke and others and grill them on what they did. They should grill themselves. I mean, a lot of the big decisions were made by Congress.
Such as?
Well, expanding the home mortgages and fueling Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the two giant home loan organizations. That really fueled the thing. There were a lot of regulatory decisions that were taken, you know, under congressional pressure. I mean, Congress played a big role. Even some of the people who were writing the new regulatory reform bills played a big role. We all did. We were greedy. We wanted our housing prices to go up and believe that was real. We don't have to explain that the bankers were greedy, but it was everybody. I mean, I don't think—
But wait a second, everybody. I mean, they're 9.6% unemployment. Those people unemployed, it's their fault too?
Well, you know, look, obviously not everybody, but a lot of them might have bought houses thinking they would double in price and taking out loans and taking risks. I mean, I think if you want to pin the blame, it has to go on the government and the regulators. I mean, to say people respond the same way they have all across time. They see housing prices going up. They think they're going to go up more. They get seduced into borrowing money to take advantage of it. But the regulators really should have put their foot down and said, you know what, this party is going to end, and we should be a little more proactive in doing something about it. But then think about it. The voters don't like that. So if you're a politician delivering the message that there are risks, it's very hard. I actually started talking and writing about the U.S. borrowing from abroad. It concerned me a lot in the early 2000s. And I would get asked by politicians, reporters, others, well, when's it going to happen? Is it going to happen tomorrow? And I said, well, I don't know, 5 years, 8 years, something like that. It's a typical, I really can't say beyond that. And they said, you got to be kidding. I mean, you know, then they just go back to what they're doing. So if you were a regulator and you tried to get tough, maybe you'd get booted out or get a call from your senator or congressman. That happened all the time.
Well, you've obviously looked at a lot of history. That's the point of This Time is Different. What does this crisis – which crisis does this one most resemble? The Great Depression of the 30s, something earlier? What historical events speak to you as similar in some way to this one?
Well, I think happily it isn't the Great Depression, and I think it could have been. And for all the finger pointing about what was done, you know, in the financial crisis, I think, you know, we should be thankful that it didn't happen. It really could have been worse.
That's sort of Barack Obama's slogan now. It could have been worse. Well, which is not exactly a rousing slogan, but it seems to be the message.
No, I think it's fair. And frankly, I think this recession we're having was baked in a cake. We are following the norms at the moment. I think if one could fault his messages before, it was that it's a bit too cheerful. He wanted to project confidence, but frankly, it was really premature. This recession was very, very tough to derail.
It's funny. You say, you have to point the finger at government. I mean, what about the banking industry? What about Countrywide? What about Bear Stearns getting so involved in, securitizing subprime mortgages? What about greed in the private sector? Is it really government's fault more than the private sector?
Well, do you think we somehow invented greed in the United States during this period? We may have celebrated it and worshipped it at times, but I don't think we invented it. I mean, you try to develop society and our institutions in a way to try to manage it in a constructive way. Capitalism at its best actually does that. This was capitalism run amok. I mean, they just drank the Kool-Aid too much. They believed it too much. I mean, obviously, some very greedy people were very successful and made a lot of money. And, you know, there are lots of ugly stories about that. But at the same time, I think it really is the responsibility of our regulators, our government, and then ultimately us, the voters, to support that. Because if we're voting out of office, the people are trying to, you know, put the brakes on, what can you do? And, Yeah, I got to say, Americans are not very good about taking their medicine. I mean, we're convinced we can borrow and borrow. Where nothing's ever going to happen to us. The only country really with a consumption rate as high as ours around is Greece. I mean, it's that's our mentality. So we're to blame for our politicians.
My guest is Kenneth Rogoff. We're discussing his latest book, This Time is Different, 8 Centuries of Financial Folly, which is published by Princeton University Press. We'll continue after we take a little break. Stay with us. I'm back with Kenneth Rogoff, whose book is This Time is Different, 8 Centuries of Financial Folly. So, again, let's go back to a little bit of history. Tell us about Edward III.
So the first international financial crisis default in our books actually in 1340 when Edward III of England invaded France as part of what we call the Hundred Years' War.
That was, I believe, the year that Lenny started this program. No, it's not true. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Might have been a little after that. And he had borrowed from Italy, which was the New York of its time, the Florentine lenders. And he wasn't successful. What do you know? That's why it lasted 100 years. And he defaulted. And it caused a big crisis in Italy. You know, it's funny. When word got back to Florence that he had defaulted, nobody knew exactly how much British debt the different banks held, just like with the subprime debt these days. and it started a panic. But
and how long did it take to sort of unravel?
A few years, actually, in that one. But one of the things
that doesn't sound very long, given the speed of communication and whatnot.
Well, I mean, we don't have the data on GNP and what happened after this. Oh, the speed of communication, you know, is faster than you think. I mean, I think the word was reached in a few weeks that that it got there. But, you know, we often think of financial crises as things that happen to other people in other places at other times. But, I mean, Spain, who's obviously compromised now, everybody's worried about the Spanish banking system, they defaulted 13 times on government debt over the course of their history. There are record holders. France has defaulted 8 times. I mean, that's quite a regular pattern over history.
And you say there's a regular pattern. So what happens to a country that can't pay its debts?
Well, if it's a country, the government.
Sovereign debt.
Sovereign debt.
Is what it's known
as. You know, it typically you go through a pretty mean recession because you're having to make a big adjustment. You would have had to make it anyway probably because you were borrowing like crazy and now you're not. And it makes it really hard for everybody else. I mean, if the government was responsible but the corporations weren't, for example, the private sector, they're still in trouble. I mean, they're not going to be able to get money. And often it takes years. After the Great Depression and the defaults of World War II, it took decades really to renormalize things. In modern times, sometimes just within a few years, a country can be back on its feet. Look at Argentina now. They defaulted at the end of 2001 and you know, they can do some borrowing anyway in international markets. And it's not like they're running their policy really responsibly either, by the way.
You said earlier that this recession is following a very predictable course. What is that course?
Well, first of all, the big rise in unemployment is very typical. We're just about, you know, that we went up 6%, going up 7% is the average. Having housing prices collapse, the mean of our post-war crises is about 35% in inflation-adjusted terms. We're almost there. The stock market fall, the average in our sample in real terms is 56%. That's about how much Standard & Poor's went down. Debt, government debt, that typically soars in the aftermath of recession, typically doubles. And what do you know? I won't surprise any of your listeners to hear we're way on track to that. It typically doubles within almost doubles within three years. So that, you know, those are some of the trajectories we've been following. And it's just a slow slog out of it. And I don't think there's any magic bullet. I think people who say there is are wrong. We borrowed a lot. It takes time to work its way out of its system. There's just no easy way for this whole thing to get absorbed.
And when you say slow slog, what do you mean? Do you mean 2 more years? Do you mean 20 more years? What's – I mean, to just be practical about it, The unemployment rate is now 9.6%. How long is it going to be in the 9% range?
Well, it easily could be sitting up near there still at the end of next year. It even could get a little worse before it gets better. But, you know, hopefully in 3 or 4 more years, we'll have normalized. I'm afraid normal will not be what it was. Probably when we were at 4%, that wasn't real either. That was a boom. But people said this time is different. You know, we can have really low unemployment. They were wrong.
So obviously this is a highly politically charged environment. It's always a politically charged environment. The fatalistic approach, you're saying, does anything that the government does anything the government do can make a difference?
Well, I mean,
I'm talking about in the recovery period, not in the getting us into this mess period.
Yeah, they were really good at getting us into the mess.
Right.
But certainly we didn't have a second Great Depression. And you can, you know, say, well, I don't give you any credit for that. That we had a chance. I don't know, it was 10%, 20%. And so a lot of the policies taken staved that off. I don't agree with everything that was done, the bailout of AIG. We wish it never happened. Some of the bailouts of some of the money that was transferred to the banks need not have happened. But, you know, still these casualties happen. At this point, you really have to avoid panicked responses. I mean, if things get much worse, sure. But I think you have to keep an eye on the fact the debt is soaring. I'm not in favor of reducing the fiscal stimulus really fast. I don't want to do anything really fast. But I do think you have to sort of try to gradually, over many years, try to normalize things. And the same thing with monetary policy. It probably needs to stay soft for a very long time
Just to translate that, soft monetary policy means keeping interest rates very low for a long time.
At the very least, they really even need to think about preventing prices from falling. If that happens, that is a risk, because falling prices worsens debt problems. Why is that? Because your salaries, the prices are going down to service the same debt. That's what happened in the 19th century in the United States. All those stories about the mean bankers foreclosing on the farmers and all those, the plays and stuff, were really about this period of deflation. That would be a disaster, and they would have to move more aggressively then.
This is Jeffrey Toobin of CNN and The New Yorker, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate on WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm speaking with Kenneth Rogoff, Harvard professor, who is the author of This Time is Different, 8 Centuries of Financial Folly. Again, before we go back to the current situation, just a couple of more sort of bizarre anecdotes from your book. Tell us a little about Newfoundland, which was at one point an independent country.
Well, Newfoundland actually lost its independence over its default in the 30s.
And this is the 1930s.
The 1930s, and got absorbed into Canada really as part of the
debt. I guess I didn't realize that Newfoundland was a separate country that recently.
Well,
I don't give a lot of thought to Newfoundland usually, but just never realized that.
You know, nowadays if Greece defaults, a significant possibility, nobody's talking about having an invasion of Greece to do anything about it. But that happened routinely before. Britain invaded Turkey, Egypt to collect debts. The United States did that to Haiti, Venezuela. You know, this was something that happened often. I wouldn't exactly say that's how Newfoundland's still a pretty poor province. But, yeah, it actually lost its independence in the Great Depression. So you asked what can happen to countries when they default. I don't think the United States would lose its independence. But if you're small, you're vulnerable.
Now, another country that is kind of a synonym for chaos of all kinds, political, military, economic, is Zimbabwe, which had at one point inflation of 66,000% annually. What does that mean? How does a country function in that kind of environment?
You know, it's funny. I have a couple students at Harvard from Zimbabwe over in the past couple of years, and I asked one of them, what do you do when it's 66,000%? What do you do? And one of the students, she said, well, you can't buy anything in the stores anyway, so what's the difference? There's nothing there. I mean, it is a little bit hard to grasp. I mean, they're printing money at such a rate as to make it worthless. There have been episodes like that in history. Just
Weimar Germany is famous people of, you know, with wheelbarrows full of cash to buy loaves of bread.
And you'd give it to your children would meet you with their bicycle to race with the cash to town before it became worthless.
So countries like that, do they ever recover? I mean, Zimbabwe.
Germany's doing okay.
But there were a few difficulties in the interim after Weimar Germany, I think it's safe to say.
You're right about that. Yeah. It's a sign of just huge dysfunction. But, you know, Brazil had 1,000-2,000% inflation twice in the end of the 80s, the beginning of the 90s. Argentina had one, so we call them hyperinflations. And yeah, Brazil's doing great today. I mean, you can recover from it, but you really need to stabilize. You need to get people's confidence back. It's a very, very awful thing to go through.
And you, at one point earlier in your career, worked at the IMF, which attempts to manage global relationships, particularly with developing countries, to smooth these terrible problems. How do you think the IMF does at its job?
Well, you know, this has been a great recession, whatever you want to call it, for the IMF. They had been very marginalized because no one wanted their money. The African countries didn't even want their money.
Why didn't they want their money?
They had came with various conditions. They could get it from the Chinese for nothing, you know, so why bother dealing with people who are going to tell them they have to be careful about their budget deficits and have a simpler tax system and such. So, you know, certainly the IMF has really emerged as a beacon of stability in this period. On the other hand, I do have concerns as things go forward. The IMF, in its efforts to be Mr. Nice Guy, has really had fairly limited conditions on a lot of these big loans going out around the world, particularly in Eastern Europe. And at some point it has to tighten the screws on places like the Ukraine, Hungary, Greece, when it comes to that. And that may not be pretty. I mean, a lot of what the IMF's blamed for over the years, I have to say, is for this telling countries that they have to obey the laws of gravity, that they can't just borrow forever.
You mentioned China as someone who is as a country that is financing development in all over the world, Africa, South America, and holds a great deal of our sovereign debt. What do you think that means for American power, economic, military in the world?
Well, I wouldn't overstate it. I mean, the big picture thing is that they're growing really fast. We're growing slow even in our good years compared to them. And, you know, over time, they'll overtake us. I don't think we're going to see the big transition in our lifetime. It may come towards the end of our children's lifetime if China does really well. I mean, they're a long ways off. That's really the big picture. This financial crisis accelerated things a bit, but you know, they're growing at 8%, 10%, and whether we're growing at 1% or 3%, it does make a difference. But I mean, that's really the big picture thing in China. Now, you mentioned their development aid; it's a concern to us because they go and do a lot of things that we sort of forbid each other from doing. They're a little freer with paying the local dictators and stuff to grab resources. They haven't signed to all the different agreements, and that's a concern. On the other hand, from their point of view, they say, hey, look, guys, you've been in Africa for a couple centuries, and look where it is. Why should we play things your way?
In our remaining minutes with Kenneth Rogoff, author of This Time is Different, Eight Centuries of Financial Folly, let's talk about sort of the hot political economic controversy of the moment, which is the Bush tax cuts. Should they be extended for everyone? Should they be extended for the wealthiest Americans? Does it matter? What's your take on that?
I just like to scrap our whole tax system. I mean, our tax system's so
messy. That's not a fair answer. You got to deal with this tax system we have.
I, I, I got to give you my gut answer. I mean, our tax system is a disaster.
Why is it such a disaster?
It's so complicated. I mean, you can talk about the loopholes, the fairness. I mean, it's just so complicated. We need a simpler tax system that has a lot less distortions. But we all have to pay more taxes. Warren Buffett, you know, has said, you know, everybody should pay a little something. And I think that's probably right. Of course, the rich should pay more. And we just can't go on running these deficits forever, and we need to move towards balancing our budget. But I'll answer your question. You know, I would favor, if left with the stark choice of just push all the tax cuts through, as I think will happen, by the way, and, you know, just do it for all but 2%. I probably favor the president's proposal, although please don't misunderstand me. I mean, I shouldn't take that as a broad endorsement of the whole policy package.
But one, you talk about the concern about deficits. We are still, I guess, still in a recession. Do you raise taxes even on wealthy people in a recession? What about the stimulative effect of leaving people to spend more money?
Well, I think Congress will find other ways to spend that money. So don't worry. You know, the deficits will get taken care of. We just need probably over time to bring up our tax take. It's very small relative to what we spend. We'd like to bring down our spending. And I think one of the things that has a lot of business people concerned is they see the health care package, great, but they think it'll cost five times what the president projects. They're very cynical. They say, look what happened with Medicare, Social Security, why isn't this the same? And I think that's a big issue. Where is this whole ship going?
Where is the whole ship going? You know, it's funny seeing you, and you seem more amused by the efforts to forestall folly than outraged about anything anybody's doing. It's my sense is that you feel a lot of this folly is just inevitable, and all this dancing around that politicians and economists do doesn't make much difference.
I'm amused by foolish things people sometimes say. I'm certainly not amused by this financial crisis, which is a disaster. And I do think the policies we took to avoid having a second Great Depression were really creative, and it was great they did that. I caution not to do anything panicked now, because it takes a long time to get out of these, and you have to be patient that there isn't really a magic bullet.
Patience. Americans are great at patience.
Yeah, really.
I've been speaking with Kenneth Rogoff, whose latest book, This Time is Different, 8 Centuries of Financial Folly, is published by Princeton University Press. Ken, thanks for being with us on The Leonard Lopate Show.
Thank you, Jeff, for having me.